Let me walk you through. I'm going to do this fairly quickly. You do need to know what hedonism is. Hedonism is a specific branch in philosophy. It has a long history, somewhat distorted in the present day, but it advocates the position that pleasure can be pursued directly as a first thing. And you understand what I mean by first and second things, right? C.S. Lewis, hedonism. Moving down here, this is Willard, number two. Number three. Now think this one through with me, and I'll actually add a few things from the end of the book, where it does get a little bit dense. The illustration I used for number three was my nephew Spencer. You know, that little guy who's watching Greg Maddux, used to pitch for the Braves. Spencer loved him, got out on the mound, and in the game tried to do everything Maddux could do. The one thing Spencer couldn't do was he couldn't throw the ball. And the reason he couldn't throw the ball was the responses in his embodied self, connected to his central nervous system, simply hadn't been developed yet. And the connection with spiritual formation is immediate. Is immediate. We will be called to respond, for example, this day. Some of you might have a great day. Some of you might have a more difficult day. And there might be instances throughout the day for all of us when suddenly we're called to respond as Christ would have us respond. That ability to respond on the spot in love, the ability, for example, to love our enemy if an enemy shows up today, the ability to control our temper if we really want to chew somebody out, whatever it might be, that ability to respond as Christ would have us respond arises out of an embodied self that has been trained effectively, formed and shaped effectively through these key means of grace that God provides to us, the classical spiritual disciplines. That's point number three. Point number four is Willard. We talked about that in some detail in class. I won't cover it here. Now, circle number five. Here's what Willard means by the phrase. We as human beings have a soul. We as human beings have an aspect of our personality that Paul calls spirit. But we also have a body. And the fundamental thesis of Willard's first 150 pages is our body plays a key role in this process of being formed more deeply into the image of Christ. And it can be, it's almost as though our body, he doesn't express it this way, but this might be helpful. It's almost as though our body is in some way neutral, and the choices we make as a self, choosing how we're going to use our body with the plasticity of its central nervous system, those choices and then living out those choices affect our body in that deeply habituated patterns of behavior are formed, right? Deeply habituated patterns of behavior are formed. So our body can be, with its central nervous system and the plasticity of the central nervous system, our body can be both an aid, depending on the choices we make, and our choices are related to our loves. Asterisk. Our choices are related to our loves, our affections. Which writer in devotional classics talks about the affections? Come on, gang. It's Jonathan Edwards. He talks a lot about the religious affections, what we love. And so, depending on our loves, which inform our choices, we choose to do things, and as we carry out our choices, what do we use? What do we use? We use our bodies, and then our bodies become habituated. So habituation, and then our habituated responses and behaviors and attitudes and so on are our what? That's our character. So the body itself can be an aid or a hindrance to spiritual development depending on the choices we've made. And I really want to stress this morning, the choices that we make are related to our loves. They are related to what we are devoted to. You got to journal about that, I would think. To think through, what do I genuinely love? To what am I devoted? And how is that devotion or love demonstrated in the choices I make each day, habit patterns that appear, and are these choices facilitating or erecting roadblocks to what Christ desires to do in me? Okay, does that make sense? Moving on here. Well, then that's number 6. He stresses number 7 because he wants us to understand that salvation means that God gives us life, supernatural life through the Holy Spirit, to live differently. It entails, salvation entails redemption, it entails forgiveness, it entails justification, it entails regeneration, it entails all of these wonderful truths that the Apostle Paul in particular talks about. But the whole thing is life. The life of God communicated to us in our embodied self through the power of the Spirit. But that life is sometimes communicated, immediately. And oftentimes that life is communicated through means of grace. So for example, God imparts his life to us in worship. God imparts his life to us in study. God imparts this wondrous life of the age to come to us as we fast, as we pray, and so on. Make sense? Okay, that's the first overhead. Now, number 8 is important to think through. Jesus, as a human being, learns to obey. As I said before, he's not a divine computer. He learns to obey. Luke teaches us that he grew in wisdom and in physical stature. And he learned by listening to well-known rabbis, I would think. He learned by going up to the temple area and observing the sacrificial system there. So that, for instance, when his cousin John points at him and says, "Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." Jesus, by that time in his life, would have known that at least part of his work is connected to what he's seen over the years in the temple area, in the sacrificial system of the temple area. He would have begun to make those equations. He learns to obey in the wilderness when he's tempted by the evil one for 40 days and 40 nights. So, Willard's point, if Christ himself, not infected with sin, not incurvatu sense, if Christ himself used very concrete means to cultivate and nourish his relationship with his Father, how much more so we in our much more troubled condition? How much more so we? Because we've got cancer. He didn't have cancer, and yet he learned to obey as an embodied self. We've got cancer, and we need chemo. We need it. We need that gene therapy I've talked about. This is really mixing metaphors. In the chemo, this is really a mixed metaphor, is the practice of these classical disciplines that funnel the life of God into us. They are not the life of God themselves, but they funnel God's life into them. I come to know God. I come to experience God in prayer. So the goal of prayer is life with God. So I don't fall in love with prayer. I do what? I fall in love with God through a particular means of grace. Yeah.
I thought the need to learn to obey was due to our sinful nature. And I was wondering, if Jesus wasn't sinful, why did he have to learn how to obey?
Well, that's a good question. if Jesus is not sinful, why does the writer to the epistle to the Hebrews speaking of Christ learning obedience? Here's the point. Obedience then must be related. Learning to obey must be related to our embodied state rather than to sin itself. Now, when it comes then to Christ is, this is what we might get in some deep water here, but it's fun. Christ is genuinely human. He's not kind of human. He's fully human, apart from sin. What does that tell you about sin? We were never created for sin. Sin just kills us. Sin is like cancer cells in our body. So he's genuinely human. And the early church had a hard time understanding this. The early church wondered, well, for instance, see number 9 here? Dekeo? Willard mentions this verb in docetism. Docetism was an early Christian heresy. And the early Christian community had a hard time fully comprehending and believing that Jesus had a human body just like yours and mine, apart from sin. So there were major debates over the first 300-400 years of the church's history. To what extent is he a human being? And so when it comes, that put an asterisk by number 9 because I'm going to ask you about that. When it comes to the question of Christ's body, there were some who were very Greek in their thinking, and they said, well, dekeo, they said he only seems to have a body. But it's not a body like ours. It only seems to be a body like ours. Maybe it was kind of, some people thought after his ascension into heaven, maybe it was a ghost-like body. But they had a hard time accepting the reality that Jesus had a brain like we have a brain. Lungs like we have lungs. Bones, blood, that he needed to breathe air. He wasn't a fish. So and then there were debates. Well, did he have a mind, a human mind? This ties in with the question of learning. Did he have a human mind like we have a human mind? And there were some early Christians who said no. It was like a human body. Christ was like a human body, some Christians taught, early Christians. And then God for a brain. And so God's brain animated a human body. All right, there's a phrase I want you to remember. This is from a great church father by the name of Gregory of Nazianzus. Now, here's what he said. This is a phrase I'd like you to know. That which is not assumed is not healed. Write that out for me. That which is not assumed is not healed. Now, here's what Gregory meant. Think of me. I have a human body that needs to be saved, yes? Yes. I have a human will that needs to be saved because it's bent, right? Yes. I have a human mind that needs to be saved. I have a human soul that needs to be saved. All of who I am needs to be saved or I'm in trouble, just like you. Now, that which is not assumed is not healed. Here's Gregory's point. Christ must have a human mind, he must have a human will, he must have a human body. If he doesn't have, if he is not all that we are, apart from sin, we're in trouble. Get his point? We're in trouble. Because we ourselves have a human mind, a human will, a human body. We have all this that makes up what a human being is. So he must be all that we are so that all that we are can be saved through what he gives to us. So he is genuinely human in every aspect as we are. Hence, when it gets to the issue of learning, in the mystery of what's known as the hypostatic union, you have a divine nature and human nature joined together in an ineffable union. That means it's indescribable. You cannot fit it into human speech or language. He is God incarnate. But what that union does not mean is that somehow he stepped outside of the normal processes of human life. Did Jesus sleep? That's a yes. Did Jesus sleep? He slept. Did Jesus speak with a mouth and a tongue? Yes. Did Jesus think with a human mind? Yes. Did Jesus learn? Yes. Just as we. However, so that's the answer to the question. You know, is learning to obey simply related to human evil and sin? No, it's broader than that. It's broader than that. He was a sinless little boy who learned how to worship. And worship is part of obedience. He was a little boy, and he learned how to read Hebrew and how to speak Aramaic. He learned how to listen to rabbis. He heard scripture sung. He heard the Psalms sung. And he heard, here's part of obedience. He heard what he was called to, and he obeyed his father. Here's another way that obedience is not related to sin. In the Garden of Gethsemane, what are the disciples all doing? They're sleeping. What's Christ trying to get them to do? To wake up. Why? Because there's going to come a moment of horrific temptation and horror. He's praying, they're sleeping. And Willard mentions that in those last 5 or 6 pages of his book. They're sleeping. And Jesus is praying. Now, when Jesus is praying to his Father, he desires to obey his Father, right? He wants to obey his Father. Is it easy? Is it easy? My goodness, the gospel writers tell us that as he was praying, he was so stretched, so deeply grieved by what he saw before him, he was bleeding. Bleeding. He was learning what it means to obey. But he wasn't infected with sin. So, there you have it. So learning to obey is not necessarily related to human evil and sin, but we have an even greater struggle ahead of us. Because we have learned well to do what? We have learned well to disobey. And that's a learning that needs to be unlearned. Unlearned. We need to reverse the tape. We need to erase aspects on the tape to blend metaphors. I leave 10 to you, 11, and I think it's pretty well self-evident now. You want to ask yourself the question, though. Let's think of it this way. As you analyze over the course of the semester who you are and where your strengths and weaknesses lie, then I would think that as you decide which spiritual disciplines you will particularly invest yourself in, you would choose those disciplines that particularly address where you're weak, not where you're strong. Where you're weak, not where you're strong. I've given the illustration of my own personality, left to myself, self-indulgent. I want what I want when I want it. So there's a particular spiritual discipline that's helping me over the years to unlearn that and to replace, what do you think the antonym of self-indulgence is? What's the opposite of self-indulgence? Self-control. Self-control. So what does fasting do? Fasting trains me as an embodied self in such a manner that finally, remember how we used sowing to the Spirit last class? So finally, I keep planting seeds in this field, and what begins to blossom in the field? Little flowers of self-control. No, it sounds kind of funny, but I think that's how it works. Little flowers of self-control. So while I still deeply love Dunkin' Donuts, you know, I don't have to go every day. One day a week is fine, maybe two. But not every day, and not 4 donuts, maybe 1. See what I'm saying? Take a look in Willard now, toward the end of the book. This relates to what I've just said. So turn, grab Willard and turn over to page 137. If memory serves me correctly, I'll ask you about this dynamic. Yeah. I'm going to start reading on page 137. This section where we have in block letters, Master of Spiritual Life, on page 137 of Willard, Master of Spiritual Life, that's where I'm going to start. Now, he's a careful writer, though he writes densely. Note when he speaks like this, but more than anything, that should catch your attention when a writer writes like that. But more than anything and most important, circle it when he writes like that. Most important for our goal of understanding the disciplines for the spiritual life, we must recognize that Jesus was a master of life in the spirit. We've already stressed that. He is the great teacher. He showed us that spiritual strength is not manifested by great and extensive practice of the spiritual disciplines, but by little need to practice them and still maintain full spiritual life. What he means by that is that as Jesus grew up, he's not infected with sin like we are. As he grew up, he learned to pray, he learned to worship, he learned these different practices, and they became avenues of growth and development and maturity for him. But we're not practices that he practiced like Spencer is going to practice something to learn how to throw a baseball. Spencer was way back at the beginning. He says, when we look closely and fundamentally at Jesus, we don't lose sight of this one fundamental crucial point. The activities constituting the disciplines have no value in themselves. That's in italics. That must be important. The aim and substance of spiritual life, oftentimes, I would bet you 90% of the students get this wrong on the exam, so I'm trying to help here. The aim and substance of spiritual life is not fasting, prayer, hymn singing, frugal living, and so forth. Rather, it is the effective and full enjoyment of active love of God and humankind in all the daily rounds of normal existence where we're placed. Is that clear? You know, I don't wake up in the morning thinking, oh man, I just love to fast. I can't get enough of it. I just love to study, or I just love to learn what it is to live a simple life. This is what spiritual life is all about. No, no, no. It's not about fasting, and it's not about study, and it's not about prayer. It's about God and learning to love God and our neighbor. See his point? And these means, prayer, silence, solitude, meditation, service, worship, all these things are means that God has ordained to enable us to learn how to love. So the mark of the spiritually mature person is not someone who's just practicing every spiritual discipline inside, and that's all they talk about. The mark of the spiritually mature person is they look like Christ and they know how to love. They know how to love God and they know how to love their neighbor. They've matured. They're no longer a seed in the field. They've blossomed. And people who are really mature are like oak trees, because the DNA in that seed has blossomed into an oak tree. How was that oak tree fed and nourished? It was watered. It was watered and fertilized. How so? Prayer, silence, solitude, and so on. See how it works? But it would be ironic. Ironic for one to think I can grow into an oak tree but never experience the therapy I need. I can grow into an oak tree but never drink in water from the ground, never experience photosynthesis. Somehow I'm just a unique oak tree. Well, no, it just can't possibly work that way. So next paragraph. People who think that they are spiritually superior because they make a practice of a discipline such as fasting or silence or frugality are entirely missing the point. The need for extensive practice. He writes very carefully. The need for extensive practice of a given discipline is an indication of our weakness, not our strength. We can even lay it down as a rule of thumb that if it's easy for us to engage in a certain discipline, we probably don't need to, what's the verb? Practice it. Like an athlete practices. You know, Michael Jordan, I'm telling you, when he would practice, he would not go out to the basket and shoot 150 layups. What, you think he did that? It was just second nature to him. He didn't have to think about it. Look at the next line. Baseball player Pete Rose, when asked to explain his phenomenal success as an athlete, said, quote, I practice. See, he's used that word practice at least four or five times here. I practice what I'm not good at. Most folks practice what they're good at. The same is true for our success in our spiritual living. So I think the way to handle this issue of the spiritual disciplines is, first of all, number one, ask yourself, what am I not good at? That's why self-analysis of some kind, self-awareness, is surely helpful at this point. And to do it before God and surround it all with the grace of God. This is a triple asterisk, if I can put it that way. Everything starts with the grace of God. Everything starts with the love of God. I believe I said this in the first class. God is not going to be surprised by something you learn about yourself. God will not say, oh, I didn't know you were like that. You're sinful. Who would have thought? God is not like that. God loves you at the beginning of your story. And then he asks you to change. So what are you not good at? And then the second question is this. Which of those classical disciplines of the spiritual life can help you become good at something that you're not good at? So, for example, some of us are not good at leading a chaste life. We struggle with sexual sin. Or we struggle with money. Or we struggle with dot, dot, dot. Then the question becomes, all right, that's the reality of the situation. So we confess and say, Lord, I'm struggling to lead a chaste life. I'm not good at it. And he says, I know. I know. And you say, I need help. He says, I know. And then, see, there'll be certain of those classical disciplines. This is so encouraging. There'll be certain of those classical disciplines that can help us learn how to live a chaste life. With the result that 6 months from now, a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, we have what? In that particular area, we've changed. We've changed, and we're healthy spiritually in that particular area where we were struggling. In the second half of the course, we'll talk about certain disciplines that can help us in that particular area. See how it works? But I don't know why it is, but when I ask questions on the midterm about this, I got to say 90% of students will get it wrong, and they'll think, you know, spiritually disciplined people are people who really practice lots of disciplines. Or spiritually mature people are ones who practice lots of disciplines. No, they'll pray. But they're not practicing it. It's just part of the rhythm of their life. We practice, can't stress this enough, we practice strategically. We practice those things we're not good at. So for instance, if you have trouble with the truth, some people struggle with the truth. And they've fallen into a habituated pattern of behavior where they lie. If you struggle with cheating on exams, something like that. All right. That's a struggle. That's what you're not good at. We confess it, and then we say, Lord, how can I learn to be an honest person? An honorable person at that point. All right. So when you think sowing to the Spirit, you understand what I mean by that, right? Sowing to the Spirit is sowing seed in the field of the Spirit through these means of grace that God gives us. So we change, and the mark of change is love. In a false spirituality or a hollow spirituality, the mark of change would be self-righteousness. In a false spirituality, the mark of change would be moral rigorism. Would be that person who've changed just enough to think they've really changed, and now their eyes are off themselves and onto other people, and they're watching and measuring who's really changing like I'm changing. The mark of change is love. Now, we've talked in great detail about 91 through 93, but go back and review it. And that phrase, the plasticity of the central nervous system, is, I think, something that we now would understand. When you think plasticity of the central nervous system, connect it immediately to habit formation. Habit formation. Love does not appear spontaneously, for the most part. Infatuation does. I can't tell you how many people I've been infatuated with, but God help them if I'd ever married them. You know, God help us both. Love is something different. Spirituality and habit, we've talked about, note the page numbers. Now, in light of what I've said this morning, doesn't 18 make sense? Where we're asking the question again, what am I not good at before God? Another way of saying what am I not good at is what are the sins I keep confessing again and again and again. That's what we're not good at. Moving on here, number 19, this is what I mentioned earlier. Willard makes a very interesting point about what's going on in the Garden of Gethsemane. And both Willard and Richard Foster actually teach this. The spiritually disciplined person knows what to do and how to do it. Let me say that again. The spiritually disciplined person knows what to do and how to do it. I'll add a few things on here. The spiritually disciplined person, because of what the disciplines allow to flow into our lives, the spiritually disciplined person, I would argue, has a high wisdom level. High wisdom level. So that when they encounter a situation that's difficult and tangled and demanding, they know how to respond. And they know how to respond in love. Now, in the Garden of Gethsemane, I said this earlier this morning, that's why, Willard argues, that's why Jesus keeps trying to wake the disciples up. He knows that if they keep sleeping, they will not be prepared for what's about to happen. He tries to wake them up, does he not? Do you remember? In the Garden of Gethsemane, he tries to wake the disciples up at least twice. Twice. And they can't stay awake. And then all hell breaks loose. And they don't know how to respond. So all Peter knows to do is pull out a sword and chop somebody's ear off. And Jesus says, stop it. Put that sword back in its sheath. And he heals that person's ear. He was ready. They weren't. He was ready, Willard argues, he was ready because he was praying fervently, because he knew what he was going to face, though he was not sinful. And they are weighed down with sleep. And then suddenly something unexpected happens. We are all going to face the unexpected. I wish I could tell you we could just skate through life and things will be fine, and every story be exactly what we wish it would be. such is not the case as we live between the times. Some of you this day, will suddenly be touched by the unexpected. And it might be deeply demanding, deeply grieving, could be very hard. But you'll be ready. You'll be ready, and increasingly ready as time goes on, as we adopt the manner of life that Jesus himself lived as that great master of the spiritual life. All right, I want you to turn to page 151. Yeah, this will be helpful now. I was just talking about Gethsemane, right? First paragraph that begins on 151 of Willard's book, where he says this, let's return to the biblical scene of Christ's last evening with his disciples in the Garden of Gethsemane. The disciples were full of good intentions. They really were. They were full of good intentions. Peter had already promised, Lord, even if I'll fall away, I'll never fall away. You can count on me. Remember, that's good intentions. But Jesus understood their condition. In light of this knowledge, he advised a course of action that would enable them to do what he knew they sincerely wanted to do. We could journal about this. What do you sincerely want to do? Yourself, in terms of your life, change. What do you sincerely want to do? It's a really important question, worth a couple weeks' reflection, maybe over spring break. What do you sincerely want to do? So Jesus, to help them to be able to do what they sincerely want to do, this is in Matthew 24:41, he says this, watch and pray that ye enter not into temptation. The spirit is indeed willing, but the flesh is weak. Why? Their flesh has been deeply habituated as a result of choices. So he's trying to keep them awake. The plain meaning of this advice to his sleepy and worried friends was that by engaging in a certain type of action, the keeping of vigil combined with prayer, they would be able to attain a level of spiritual responsiveness and power in their lives that would be impossible without it. In this simple but profound episode, we find the whole nature and principle of the kind of activity that's a spiritual discipline. Underline that. Go back and read it. Let me read it again. This is, if you don't have your book, page 151, study it. In this simple but profound episode, we find the whole nature and principle of the kind of activity that's a spiritual discipline. Such an activity implants in us, like a seed. It implants in us in the embodied personality that's the carrier of our abilities and disabilities because of the choices we've made. A readiness and an ability to interact with God and our surroundings in a way not directly under our control. Those disciples couldn't, and Jesus could not control what was going on in the Garden of Gethsemane. There were too many soldiers, too many guards. They couldn't control the circumstances. They could control how they reacted to the circumstances, how they reacted. The disciples, because they're asleep, cowardly, run. Christ, because he's prepared himself, moves right into his passion. He's ready. He's ready for what God's going to ask of him. I know I look at you, and I want you to ask this question. It's a very sober question. Someday, God will ask something of you. He will ask something of you. And I want you to be prepared for what he asks. Oftentimes, what he asks of us will be good and hard. At other times, he'll just ask us to deeply trust as we're struggling with sin. He'll ask us deeply trust when we bury somebody we deeply love and we thought they were going to get well, or there's been an accident. It happens sooner or later. What is he going to ask of us? And what Foster and Willard and I'm trying to do are to prepare us both for this particular day and for those other days when something unexpected does happen, like the Garden of Gethsemane. One of the things that Americans have such a hard time with is facing the reality that as they grow older, harder things happen more often. And finally, they get sick. And 33% die after a long, protracted illness. 33% die after a short, intense illness. These are the stats, folks. And 33% are killed. Those are the stats. Sorry. Well, it's all right. From the Christian perspective, we live between the times. So we prepare ourselves to be able to love even as we are asked to do something very difficult. All right, what's the great deception? Last thing, page 152. And I leave you with this. The preparation for all of life's actions. And whenever he italicizes in the text, note it. Like here, when he italicizes all. The preparation for all of life's actions, including the spiritual, essentially involve bodily behaviors. Watching or vigil. Vigil is when we choose not to sleep. It doesn't mean we're going to be watching Star Trek at 3 in the morning. We choose not to sleep. We choose to stay awake because we need to pray because we're facing something. We're facing something or will be facing something, and we need to be prepared. Watching or vigil, for example, is a bodily behavior, is it not? I should think. Of course, it's not only a bodily behavior, but the point we are in greatest danger of missing in our contemporary culture is that it is also not purely spiritual or mental, and that whatever is purely mental cannot transform the self. What we think is extremely important. And he talks about that in some detail. What we think is extremely important. I ran across this phrase somewhere, I don't know where I got it. Stinking thinking. So there's a branch of psychology known as cognitive psychology, and it deals with how we think. But his point is, we'll get well sometimes, not by simply changing our thoughts, but actually by changing our behaviors, what we do with our bodies. Next paragraph. One of the greatest deceptions, here's the great deception. One of the greatest deceptions in the practice of the Christian religion is the idea that all that really matters is our internal feelings, ideas, beliefs, and intentions. What really matters, finally, is our behavior. Intentions are important, beliefs are important, ideas, thinking well, rinsing out stinking thinking. But finally, how are we behaving? Is love manifest? It is this mistake about the psychology of the human being more than anything else that divorces salvation from life. Remember, he talks about salvation as the impartation of life, leaving us a head full of vital truths about God and a body unable to fend off sin. Wow, let me read that again. Leaving us with a head full of vital truths about God and a body unable to fend off sin. What an irony. So I can remember folks talking about, what was the phrase that they would, head knowledge. Ever run across that phrase? Head knowledge. I think what they're talking about is this disjunction. Someone who might have a lot here, but what's here, think of this through with me, what's here has not made it here. It's not made it into here or here. And what Willard is arguing, this is the first 150 pages, is we can learn how to overcome that disjunction. You with me? We can learn how to overcome the disjunction. All right. Questions?
I just had a question about, like, you took the slide away and we missed three of the points.
I think I missed
three
of the points.
That's not a very profound question, but...
Well, I think maybe I missed three of the points.
It was 12, 13, and 14, I think.
Oh. Yeah, I can do these quickly. Thank you for reminding me. So, for number 12, we talked about this last class. Where is our, where, The body has a measure, as Willard puts it, of independent power. Remember that? Has a measure of independent power. I have the freedom as a moral agent to choose how I'm going to use that independent power, and therefore I'm responsible before God. Again, number 13 is one where you can just look at it yourself. I just want you to take a good look at how he defines spiritual life. Now, let me explain the dynamic of 14 quickly. I think we'll understand that the dynamic is fairly direct and forthright. For 20 years, I, as an embodied self, made choices, freely made choices, right? And those choices, some of them were deeply habituated in my body, in my mind, in my body, right? I come into the kingdom of God, and what do I experience? That, number 14. I experienced the body at that time as a battlefield. Why? Because now I'm having to learn something new. I'm having to retrain myself. And initially, it's like a battle. And we've all felt that battle. Haven't you? The last time you really wanted to do A, which you knew was the praiseworthy and the right thing to do, and your whole body is screaming, no, 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 we'll start tomorrow. Not today. That's what we're talking about, body as battlefield. Anything else? Study well. Enjoy the midterm. Have a nice spring break.